of audience. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warren of Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Anjali Kamat, Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Torrieri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. By the way, Buffy, happy, happy birthday. If you want to sign up for our daily digest, our newsletter, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Wednesday, May 28th at 5:30 p.m. This will be a hybrid meeting. It will be held at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Cascade Forest Conservancy, presenting the Understory Northwest Film Fest, a night of stories about our connections to the natural world, showing at the Keegan's Theater on Thursday, May 29th. Proceeds from the event support ongoing local conservation and habitat restoration. Tickets and info at cascadeforest.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:01 a.m. Next up is PDX Progressive Radio.
If you want it, you can have it. All you gotta do is just reach out and grab it. If you want it, you can have it. All you got to do is just reach right out and grab it.
Step on up.
Step into your power.
Step on up.
Step into your power, child.
Step on up.
Step into your power.
Step on up.
Step into your power, child. Now listen to me. All you need, you already own. It was given to you on the day that you were born. Anything that your heart can dream, you can make it reality.
Step on up.
Step into your power.
Step on up.
Step into your power, child.
Step on up.
Step into your power.
Step on up.
Step into your power, child. Listen, don't be afraid, don't be afraid to fall. It's the getting back up that's gonna make you stronger. God only made one like you. So come on, baby, and just do what you were born to do.
Step
Good morning, Portland. This is PDX Progressive Talk Radio, and I am your host, Sherry Morish. And it is awesome to be here on Wednesday morning. If you're listening live, it's May 21st, a little after 8 a.m. I have a guest today, and I am so excited to have the opportunity to talk with him and learn more about what he plans to do in the future. For longtime listeners of our evening broadcast, you have heard him before. It's Nick Walden Poblin. And yay, I said it right. And he is fabulous. I do have some bookkeeping to do before we move forward. As some of you consistent listeners may know, we just started our membership drive for summer. So this drive is KBOO's Camp KBOO Summer Membership Drive, and we are working on raising $50,000 during the next few months. So if you find it in your heart to keep my passion alive and help me stay on the air in Portland, a dream that I had for a long time, please go on over to the website and click on that donate button. There are other ways you can give. You can go to kboo.fm/give. That's G-I-V-E. Click on the red box donate button in the mobile app. Text KBOO to 44321 and mail. For those of you who don't like the text stuff, we get it. We do take paper. So you can mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. And I would really, really appreciate your help with this. We at KBOO work diligently. We are a volunteer-powered radio station. We work diligently to bring you news, entertainment, music, public affairs, everything that makes your life fulfilling, at least on the radio. So this drive goes from May 20th to June 29th, and your help is greatly appreciated. Moving forward, thank you for listening to that, by the way, and it does come from our hearts. You'll be hearing a lot about that over the next month or so, because KBOO is a vital resource in the community, as is the Multnomah Arts Center. So before I get to the interview with Nick, he's patiently waiting and I really appreciate it. I heard last night that Steve Novak on the Portland City Council is trying to take away a vital resource in Portland known as the Multnomah Arts Center. And tonight, I believe it's tonight or tomorrow night, find it. If you are in the Multnomah Village Facebook group, they're talking about this. They're talking about some plans to make their vision known that the Multnomah Arts Center and all of the organizations affiliated with it bring so much value to the community. I read that Steve Novak in his on OPB had an article, and I don't have it right in front of me, but in the article it stated that that's his brainchild idea for saving $2 million in a $93 million deficit. Okay, I can't tell you because I haven't had time to do any calculations or talk to people, but that center, the Multnomah Arts Center, I adore that place. We did Moses's campaign kickoff party there this past Saturday. We had his memorial there. They provide art education for of all mediums, so you know, the active arts and actual art. They have a little art gallery that they show off different works on a monthly basis, I believe. They have classes, they have a basketball court, they have a beautiful courtyard with a stage. And they are affiliated with many other organizations, such as the Columbia Basin Basketry Guild, the Neighborhood House, Oregon Children's Theater, Print Arts Northwest, Community Policing, and Northwest Wood Tuners. They provide way more benefit to the community than the supposed $2 million savings that Novak is talking about. So if you're listening in Multnomah Village or you are associated with any of the programs that the Multnomah Arts Center supports, please call me and let's have a discussion on that. The phone number is 503-231-8187. Let me get through this interview with Nick and I will open up the phone. So it's going to be a few minutes. Nick is fabulous. He was running for District 52.
You got it.
Yeah, District 52. His name is Nick Poblin, Nick Walden Poblin. He's actually become a good friend of mine. I adore this man. And I supported him through his effort to get into the Oregon State Representative, Oregon House of Representatives. And so I'm so happy. Hello, Nick.
Hello.
It's good to have you.
It's good to be back.
Could you give our daytime? We made it. We made prime time, man.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Can you give our prime time morning listeners a rundown of who you are, what you're passionate about,
yeah,
what you're doing now, and future plans?
Yeah, well, like Sherry said, my name is Nick Walden Poblin, and I grew up in Harrisburg, Oregon. So shout out to Harrisburg, Linn County. It's a small grass seed town. My family were dairy farmers. I went to a two-room school that was actually public school, K through eighth grade. So two rooms, 24 students, kindergarten through eighth grade, a lot of my siblings in the same classes. So I grew up very, I like to say it was very much like Little House on the Prairie, if that was possible, but it was really a great community that I grew up in. And went to the University of Oregon for a short period of time, and then went to Portland State University, where I really kind of stepped into my power. Learned a place where I really learned a number of things that have propelled me into the places that I am now. And that is that I just got done in 2024 running for state representative and lost that race by 3 points, but against the Republican minority leader, who was an incumbent and who had a lot more resources than I had. So I'm very proud of the race that we ran. I'm very proud of the things that we learned. I'm animated a lot by healthcare policy. That's something that happened at PSU while I was there. I ended up getting sick my first week of grad school with a tumor at the base of my brain, and it kind of rearranged everything in my life. And I'm so thankful that I had that resource there at PSU, and that there was a place for me to find my voice and really propelled me to the position that I'm in now too.
Very, very awesome. That was quick.
Oh, good.
That was a quick rundown.
No,
that was a quick rundown, and that was perfect. And what you are doing now, and as your profession at the moment.
Yeah, I'm substitute teaching,
yes,
which is not something I ever saw on the horizon. I taught at Portland State University. I taught Western Civ to large classes of primarily adults. So this is really new for me. But my husband is a sixth grade school teacher, and I thought... I watched the work that he was doing and the reward that he was getting out of the work that he was doing. And so I got my license and I started teaching, and I teach everything from kindergarten to high school. And the first thing I have to say is that the people that are working in our schools, and that I call them educators, and I mean teachers and the support staff, are some of the most phenomenal people that I have met in the state. They are really great people doing really great work,
yes,
working very hard. And I want to say that before I say anything that sounds anywhere near being critical of the education system, because I come into this just as an outsider. I've only been doing it for 3 or 4 months. I'm learning the ropes, but I see that there are places where we need resources. And when we talk about educational cuts that are coming or may be coming, it really scares me, because I see the thin rail that we're working on right now and the thin resources that our educators are working with right now. And it scares me about what do we do when we take more of those resources away, and what are we doing for children, and how are we serving children?
Well, there's a long history of that, and I plan actually on addressing that soon, because I moved to Seattle in 1994, leaving Portland, where I had been homeless, right? And no sooner, I think it was 1996, Governor Locke made an announcement that educational resources for the state of Washington were going to be on the budget cutting block. And it's just been horrible ever since then. The teachers aren't getting the resources they need. All three of my kids went through Washington State schooling system at different times. And my daughter, my oldest, actually graduated from Peninsula High School. So I have experience with the kids in school and the struggles that the teachers have to live through to be able to teach the next generation. And so that's something that's like center in my heart. So we'll be talking about that again at some point.
I think there's this misunderstanding that a teacher teaches a class and it's one class. Yeah. And there are 25 students and they're all looking in the same direction like they do in the clip art. It's not like that.
No.
There are many different classes going on within a class, because there are students at different varying levels of need.
Worse now. You used to have, when we were growing up, segmented, right? So your children who needed more help got the more help they needed outside of the general population. And I thought that was always a good idea, because they were able to focus and the teacher had less weight on them.
Yeah.
Right? So I have a question for you.
Sure.
So speaking of this, actually, frontline perspectives, as a substitute teacher, you've had the unique vantage point in various classrooms. What have these experiences revealed about the current state of our education system outside of what you've already addressed?
Yeah, we need more resources. I mean, that's
in what way?
In what way? I think there are children who are in our classrooms who need one-on-one assistance, who are not receiving that one-on-one assistance
consistently.
Yeah. And there are also classrooms that I come into when I'm a sub, and I can tell you how long it's been since the original teacher's been gone. Because sometimes these classrooms are having subs for weeks on end. And that is really tough on a student. And if you're a parent and your kid is in one of that situation, you know what I'm talking about. The inconsistency of having someone in every day. And my job as a substitute teacher is to come in, provide as much consistency as I can. Let's do things like we did it yesterday. Let's try to provide you with a schedule as much as I possibly can. Let's hold something, hold the line, you know?
Right.
But it's hard when they've had multiple subs, and I can read the notes from subs going back days and days and days, and sometimes they just haven't had, for no reason of the educator or the school or the student, it's just sometimes life happens and someone has to step away. Yeah. And so we need to be able to have, a stronger support system for our educators. I think we need to have more one-on-one resources available for some of our students. And I think that we need to make sure that we hold the line as far as resources go. We're asking them to perform a number of different jobs with very thin resources on a really tight schedule.
I hope Governor Kotek is listening to this.
I hope she's listening to this.
I'm not sure that she is. I'm not that big yet. We aren't that big yet. But yeah. So navigating lockdowns.
Yes.
You've mentioned an upcoming op-ed about your first lockdown experience as a substitute teacher. Can you share what that day was like and the emotions it provoked?
Yeah, I had to write about it because I literally couldn't stop thinking about it, Sherry. It was going through my head all the next week, the week after that.
Wow.
I was in a second grade class. It's me and 27 second graders. And someone comes over the loudspeaker and says that there is a reason to lock down, that there has been I don't remember the exact words, but someone had come onto campus and we needed to lock down. And these 27 students knew exactly where to go. They turned off the lights, we locked the doors, and then we hid in by the cabinets for what seemed like to me forever. And some of these children were having really hard time. They were scared. They wanted me to tell them that it was a drill. It didn't seem to be a drill to me. Usually when you're a substitute, you get a heads up about those kinds of things. This didn't seem to be a drill to me. And I, in that instance, I thought, I don't have children. I have nieces and nephews. We talked about that. I have 10 nieces and nephews. In that instance, I thought, what a leap of faith it is that a parent takes every day when they send their child to school. What a leap of faith to give me, a substitute, your child's hand and have faith that I'm going to get them through this moment. And I am, and I did, and we did. And I thought about the travesty that it is. It hurt to think that these children have to be taught to hide while they're being taught to read. And that those two things are commingled.
All because of our government.
Because of a lot of things. The way we fund our education, the way we approach guns, the way that we approach mental health. I mean, there are a lot of things that go into this mixture. And, you know, the they tell us after a certain number of minutes, you can come, you can get back up and get into your seats. The children pop back into their seats, and they are braver than I am. They went right back to what they were doing. And it was me that kind of walked around the room and said, has that happened before? Have you done that before? Is that normal? I mean, did we do it for longer than normal? You know, I'm the one asking. I was shook.
Yeah.
And they, for them, it was an average day. And I think that made it even, that may resonated with me even more. And so I when we talk again about cutting educational resources, I sound like a broken record. But when we talk about cutting educational resources, I worry about resources that keep our students safe.
Right. Well, and speaking of which, from your perspective, how effective are current school safety measures and what improvements might you advocate for?
I think we do a really good job with the resources that we have. It's hard to get into our schools, which it should be. And I think that given the way the schools were built at, for a different time and a different, you know, where school shootings weren't something that were on their mind, a lot of the older schools that I work at that were built in the 1960s, 70s, you know, we're doing the best job with the infrastructure that we have to keep people out. And I think that the children, like I said, in that situation, the children knew exactly where to go. They knew what to do. Most of them remained calm because for them, they had done this before. So in that regard, I think we're doing a good job of teaching an impossible lesson that we shouldn't have to be teaching in the classroom.
Right.
I worry about schools just being safe places because I worry about that all the time. My husband's a teacher. I'm a teacher. I worry about kids. I think that we could probably step up some of the security levels. I don't know exactly what could be done in those situations. I think each school does the best job they can with the kind of building that they have, with the kind of entrances and exits they have going on. But I never show up to work in the morning without having to say who I am, what I'm there for, and prove that I am a substitute for that day. Because I teach at like 10 to 15 different schools.
Right.
So
making you check in.
Oh yes. And parents are
huge
making
issue.
Me check in and say who I'm subbing for and make sure that person is going to be absent that day. So there's checks and measures, and parents are held at a distance because, you know, they don't know who a parent is or who a parent isn't and whether they're safe or not safe. So parents are held in the vestibule usually most of the time. They're not in the school. They're not walking around with their students. So I do feel safe.
Yeah. I find it, having children grow who went to school in the early 2000s after Columbine, we had to deal with lockdowns, and we had to deal with we went through the Nisqually earthquake when and my kids were little, and that freaked me out.
I remember earthquake drills growing up. Never.
Yeah, we had earthquake drills too. But the lockdowns were scary because you can't at the time we didn't have cell phones. You can't access. That is why I am actually against the cell phone retraction at the Portland Public Schools, where they're making the kids give up their cell phones. I am completely against that.
I think that's a really divided issue. I was doing, I was out in, not to get off topic, but I was out in the Dalles the other day doing a, I was a judge for a scholarship pageant. And one of the questions they asked the young women who were up for this award was about that, about the cell phone ban. And I was listening to their answers, and they were very mixed. Some of them supported it. Some of them were against it. I don't know what the answer is. I think as a parent, I would want to make sure I had the ability to reach my child at any time. And that would be really difficult. I think that there's some probably middle ground. Sometimes I see teachers have these cubbies up on their walls, and you come in, you put your cell phone in it, and then you go to your class, you go to your desk. And so it's within sight, but it's not within your hands. And that seems to be a way to maybe get around it. I don't know.
Well, and then during lockdowns and stuff like that, teachers could probably navigate the mm-hmm. kids' ability to access their tools to connect with their parents, mm-hmm. which I think is so important, especially with the large number of children that are being gunned down in our schools that never get to have that last conversation with their parents. And that for the parents.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, I'm just like, I'm so glad my kids aren't in school, and I don't envy parents today. Mm-hmm. Right?
No, I don't. There's a whole nother, there are many, many things you have to worry about as a parent today that just weren't an issue in my two-room school that I went to.
You are working in healthcare advocacy, mm-hmm. and I'm going to ask you one question out of here because we're running a little short on time.
Sure.
As the chair of the Democratic Party of Oregon Healthcare Caucus and a board member of the Healthcare for All Oregon, yay. That would make me vote for you. What are your primary objectives in these roles?
I think my primary objective is connecting people, is making sure that we are having conversations between the unions and the healthcare workers, and that we are having conversations between providers and policy folks like myself. I'm really proud to be the chair of the Healthcare Caucus for the state of Oregon, for the Democrats for the state of Oregon, and I will be joining the Healthcare for All board in June. So that's coming up really soon. I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but it's a matter of days. So it's coming. And I'm really excited about that too, because I think we have a real chance here in Oregon to lead and not just follow, and to really put our money where our mouth is and to provide everyone in the state with healthcare. Now, we talk about the fact that 96% of Oregonians have healthcare. That's great. I think that's a great number. But I worry about the number of those people who are underinsured. And so one of my roles as the chair of the Healthcare Caucus and someone who's going to go work on for Healthcare for All Oregon is that we focus on the quality of the healthcare that people are getting, the quality of the insurance someone's getting, because we oftentimes allow ourselves to say, oh, she has insurance. Well, if that insurance is not any good or doesn't cover anything, then she's just as good as being uncovered in the first place.
Amen.
So that's one I want to work on. I think that's another thing I would really like to work on, is just focusing on that.
And that's a serious issue, because mm-hmm. you could be having $200 a week taken out of your check, or mm-hmm. $200 a pay period taken out of your check for your insurance, and I'm using quotes, and still have to pay for your medical expenses until you get up to $4,000, and then they dictate what they will and will not cover, and that's absurd.
Absolutely.
You are literally stealing money from my check, from my paycheck every month, and refusing to cover my medical needs that I'm supposedly paying for.
Yeah.
That's fraud.
Yeah. Deductible is a dirty word.
It is.
And I think the other thing I would like to do too, and that ties into this, Sherry, a little bit too, is just work on educating people what the difference is between a deductible and a copay, and when your out-of-pocket maximum comes up and things like that. Because you need to be able to know what those words mean in order to make sure that you're getting the best deal that you can get.
Yes. Yeah, and I'm sorry, but taking money out of my check and then not covering my medical expenses is absurd.
Yeah.
It's absurd. So that tells me a couple of things. One, corporations not only don't want to pay a living wage, they have little regard for their employees, because I was told when I was in this situation that, oh, that's the plan that your employer chose.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my employer apparently doesn't care about my well-being enough to have me have good insurance that's going to take care of what I'm paying for, right?
I think sometimes you get good insurance yourself, and then you don't think about what happens to the insurance that you're providing to the people that you work for you. I think this is the same thing that happened at PSU. This was 20 years ago now, or 17 years ago now, but they were providing a shelf product when I was a student there that they had no ill intentions, but it was really just a shelf product. It was like buying macaroni and cheese. I could have just gotten it off the shelf, and it covered nothing, and it did nothing, and it was no good.
Yeah, because that's how much they care about their employees, as far as I'm concerned. If that's the level of concern you have for the mental health and physical health of your employees, why bother?
Yeah.
you know, the anyway, so let's your political aspirations. House District 52 is encompassing both rural and urban areas. How do you plan to address the distinct needs of each of these communities effectively? Because that's important. Very mm-hmm. much Malala and Sandy have different mm-hmm. Requirements or needs than, say, Happy Valley.
Correct. And none of those cities are in my district, but...
So the city's in your district.
It is outside of the city of Sandy. So the outskirts of Sandy, and I live just outside of Sandy. And then it goes up the mountain. So we're talking about Hood River, the Dalles.
Yeah.
We're talking about places like Cascade Locks, East Gresham, and East... So it takes up part of East and Clackamas County. Corbett is another great place that's in the district. So, yes, we live the urban-rural divide in this district. You can tell. I mean, Hood River is a little bit more urban in some ways than definitely than Corbett is. But Corbett is very close to Portland in some ways because you can get on 84 and be there in, you know, 12 minutes and you're kind of in Portland.
Right.
And so you can't be someone who just thinks about the rural folks or the urban folks in my district. And I will say Sandy is the largest city I've ever lived in.
Really?
Yes. I have grown up in small towns and lived in small towns, and we don't even live inside the city limits, so I can't even vote for mayor, which really irks me. But so that's why Clackamas County Commission is so important. And Sandy is the biggest city I've ever lived in. I have worked in Portland, worked in downtown Portland at Portland State University for more than 10 years. So I kind of got that, I get that urban side. And I think largely that's what makes this district so hard to run in, because you do have the Portland-centric kind of side of politics that takes place. And then you've got really the Hood River, the Dalles, and Corbett, and they don't see themselves as part of Portland, and nor should they, because they're not part of Portland. They have a very different identity and different needs. And so you have to be able to look at both sides of issues and make sure that you're representing everybody in the district, and that we focus on issues that I hear talked about constantly, and that is housing is a huge issue in the district. We have plenty of businesses that want to be able to hire folks, but that just can't get anyone to live close enough to their business to make it feasible. We have people driving in from Gresham to work at the grocery stores in Hood River, which just is crazy to me.
Yeah.
And then the other issue is, of course, healthcare, which is close, near and dear to my heart and something that I talk about constantly. And then the other issue is just making sure that education is good, that your zip code should have nothing to do with the quality of the education that you receive.
Amen.
And that your child receives, not in the state of Oregon.
Amen.
Yeah.
Amen. So when you start running again, we can get a little bit deeper into some of those subjects.
Yes, we can. And so House District 52 is going to be open, an open district in the next election. Presumably because Jeff Helfrich, Representative Helfrich, has declared that he will run for Senate in Senate District 26. And I don't think that I can have looked the people in the eye and told them that I heard them and really spent the time with them to learn to know them and know the issues of this district in the last couple of years to turn away at this point and not follow through.
Yep.
And one of the biggest things that I got told by someone who approached me early on when I first started running is that, you know, we've had so many single candidates who run for one term and then they disappear and we never see them again, and that's kind of the end of the investment. And so I knew when I was going to run in 2024 that if I wasn't successful, if I was successful, I'd run again. If I wasn't successful, I had to give it another run. I had to give it another a go because we got close enough. We learned a lot of really important lessons, and I want to make sure that those things are put to play. And then I'm able to follow through on a lot of the issues and promises that I made to people.
You had a ton of support. You had a lot of, because as I was out talking about campaign finance reform, I ran into some people in areas that were in your district.
Yeah.
And they, all of them were like, I'm voting for Nick.
We had a great campaign. It was a small campaign, but a great campaign.
Yeah.
We accomplished a lot of great things, knocked on lots of doors. I lost weight. And I learned geographically. I was not really great with, you know, my northwest, south, and east, but I learned it really well because when you're out there knocking on doors in the Dalles or in Hood River or in East Gresham, you got a map and the doors, and that's kind of all it is. Yep. It's you, the candidate, out there knocking on the doors. Yeah. So I look back and I'm so thankful for all the people who got involved in the 2024 run. And 2024 was a huge year for me. I ended up being a delegate to the National Convention, yes. Which was really amazing, and running for office and getting to be the Democratic nominee. And we were also the nominee for the Independent Party and the Working Families Party, who were integral into our success as well. And all the unions that supported us, and individuals, legislators that were helpful during that process. So,
you're reaching out to all of these people?
Oh, yes, reaching out to them, yeah.
Awesome.
Yes.
And learning, continue to learn.
Yes, it is a learning process. Yeah. And I think I am better, I know I'm better equipped today to handle the job and to do the job than I was before I started running or when it before I started thinking about running. So
amazing. Thank you for your patience and answering all my questions.
No problem.
And then some.
No.
And I'm going to open up the phones now so you can call us at 503-231-8187 and have some commentary about the Steve Novak issue with Multnomah Arts Center, or talk to my friend here, Nick, about what you've heard, his aspirations, if you would support him, what ideas you might have for him, however that works. We need to let you know that we are in the middle of a new drive. It's the KBOO summer camp. The KBOO summer camp drive. And as I was saying earlier, this show fills my soul. You guys and your support and your willingness and openness to communicate with me and call in to the show and talk with us and share your opinions is so important, and people want to hear your voices. And to do this, we need to raise $50,000 between today and June 29th. So there are several ways that you can donate. You can go to kboo.fm/give. You can text KBOO to 44321. I was looking for my script here. You can also send a check to 20 KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. And let me look that up again real quick. Sorry about this. You can call in and talk to Nick if you want.
I'm ready.
Nick is right here. He's ready for your call. That's 503-231-8187. Okay, I have my script here. So if you want to donate via the mobile app, you just click on the little red donate button. 44321. Hey, I about have this memorized. You can text KBOO to 44321. You can mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. 97214 was the zip code I could not remember. And then if you are streaming online right now, just go back over to your browser, and at the top of the KBOO page is the donate button. So you could donate there too. We, again, are trying to raise $50,000 between today or yesterday and June 29th, and we have a phone call coming in. Do you have a name? I'm sorry. Okay. Hi, caller.
Good morning.
Hi, is Jeff?
It is.
Hi. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm just dangerously well, and thanks for asking, Sherry. I hope you are too. And I think, Nick, you're to be congratulated for everything you are attempting to do and are doing. And in light of the two subjects, the Multnomah Arts Center, which I have visited before, which is an outstanding and tremendous way to bring arts and athletics to the community of Multnomah Village and greater Southwest Portland. And Nick, you're a teacher, and so these two are tied together in a serious way. You may recall just last week in Palm Springs, California, a self-professed nihilist exploded a bomb outside an in vitro fertilization clinic and put out a manifesto prior to it about how he just hated everyone and everything and didn't think humans should ever exist. And so he brought himself to his own death by this explosion. Now, I'd like to know that and get a greater understanding that the arts, generally speaking, in education are a critical element of creating, for lack of a better word, a civilized people. And of course, as you've professed already, Nick, you've been through this lockdown stuff, and the threats to it are severe. But can you speak to how arts have helped in your substitute teaching career and in the teaching career of your husband? I will gladly take your answer off the air and clear up the lines for other callers. And Sherry, thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for your insightful questions, too.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, the arts are super important to everything that we do, not only to the things that we teach in the classroom, but to even, I think, my motivation and my husband's motivation for teaching in the classroom in the first place. He teaches language arts, and I teach, you know, whatever happens to be the day. But I am often the art teacher and the music teacher. And I see kids that are otherwise disengaged throughout the day come alive in a way that they have not come alive when we do music, when we do art, when we do something that takes place outside of the textbook. And any part of me that ever doubted, and it never did doubt, the funding of the arts in education has completely been vindicated in the fact that you see these kids who are not otherwise engaged, not otherwise feeling like they're part of the classroom, literally come alive. Their eyes are involved. They're socializing with others. They're making things. They're using their hands. And you can see that education needs to be as broad as it possibly can be in order to capture every one of these little brains at this point in their lives.
That's fabulous.
Yeah.
That is. And that's why the Multnomah Arts Center is so mm-hmm. important, too.
Absolutely.
Did you know they have 15 partners throughout Portland, and they serve communities like the Rosewood Initiative, Home Forward, and Youth.
I was just there on Saturday
for Moses'
thing as well. And I was surprised by the amount of wonderful space for Moses and for his family and for his friends. And the other thing I was surprised about is I walked through like several different kinds of things going on as I was mm-hmm. on my way in there, and it was really kind of nice. There was some people fencing. There was some basketball going on. There was art. There was things being vended for sale. And then also this memorial. And it was really being used. And as someone who visited it for the first time, I was really impressed by the multi-usage of that space. And I can't imagine a situation in which it would or should be defunded or go away.
Well, they rent out a lot of the space as well.
Yeah.
As you're aware, we did the campaign kickoff party mm-hmm. in the courtyard, which has a stage. Ray Gordon, her band, played for us at the kickoff party. We were availed tables, so we had like six round tables and a bunch of chairs, and you have to rent the tables and rent the chairs separately mm-hmm. from the space, but it's affordable. Mm-hmm. You can pull something like this off for under $500. Right? Just for the space and the amenities that go with it. And that courtyard is gorgeous. When I went out there, because I wasn't sure. Moses wanted the basketball area because that's where he was used to being. And I walked out in that courtyard and I said, no, I want this. I want this right here because we're going to have the band and it's gorgeous. They have plants everywhere, trees, and mm-hmm. it's just a beautiful space. And the auditorium that the memorial service was held in, oh my goodness, yeah. It was huge. It was like a high school gym.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it reminded me
of.
With a stage. It's got, or a small theater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was just fabulous. Mm-hmm. And it held how many? I'm not even sure. We got there late, so I'm not sure how many people were there.
I don't know. I'm not good about crowd.
Yeah, there was quite
there were a lot of people there. They were bringing in chairs up until the last minute, which is great. Yeah.
And the chairs are super inexpensive to rent in the facility. So Steve Novak, you can call me at 503-231-8187 and explain yourself, sir. There's another, I'm not afraid to call people out because this is just simply wrong. The OPB article does reference another, I think it's Zimmerman's idea for a budget cut that takes out 36 inspectors and uses that money for maintenance within the Parks and Recreation District. So, I mean, it was bad enough that they're trying to take money away from policing, which honestly, I think a lot of the money that they are trying to extract from the police should go to PSR, because they're talking about that money would maintain a budget for policing at the community level service calls, mm-hmm. I believe, when PSR is the one who does a lot of those now,
right?
At least within Portland. At least that's my understanding. So, counselor, I'm reading off the OPB article. Here's how Portland counselors want to tweak Mayor Wilson's budget. And so Zimmerman, Counselor Eric Zimmerman, who chairs the Finance Committee, has proposed saving $5.8 million by cutting around 30 tree inspector jobs. I wasn't sure what inspectors. 30 tree inspector jobs of the Parks Bureau and putting the money toward maintenance. That plan also moves the city's tree regulation program from the Parks Bureau into Portland Permitting and Development. If you were on the council, does that sound like it would be, I mean, that's putting you on the spot.
Oh boy, that is putting me on the spot. If I were one of the many members of the Portland City Council. I mean,
this is theory.
This is in theory. I'm not going to put this in stone, but I mean, I would have to know more about the trees, I suppose, question.
Yeah.
But I think it makes more sense than yanking the money from a huge center like the Multnomah Arts Center.
Yeah.
I'd still be concerned to make sure those trees are getting taken care of, because that's a serious issue. But, you know, as long as it's falling to another agency, maybe that is a better way of going about things than.
Well, see, the reason why I asked is because Portland Permitting and Development would also include the environment around building infrastructure.
Okay.
So I could see how, I mean,
yeah.
How trees kind of, I mean, that kind of makes sense. So Councillor Steve Novak, meanwhile, has suggested closing two facilities run by the Parks Bureau, the Multnomah Arts Center and the Community Music Center.
Oh, wow.
This guy does not believe in arts. We have a phone call. I hope it's him. Who, what? Jane. Hi, Jane.
Jane. Hi there.
How's your day?
I couldn't get Steve Novak to call in this morning. He's just a little too busy dealing with angry citizens.
I hope so.
My day is going okay, but I'm a little angry and a little upset. And I'm appalled that the city would suggest doing this to drive a stake into the heart of the arts like this.
Right.
Already artists and children are vulnerable, as well as old people. And I want to bring attention to the fact that there is a senior citizens center that is at NEC also.
Oh.
To eliminate music lessons and dance at a time when schools have gutted them already.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the art community is already gasping for breath in a city where the commercial rents have become unaffordable.
Well, he thinks he's going to save $2 million. Rather than slashing the park maintenance budget.
Well, they've already invested over $2 million in retrofitting the building to make it safer, and they spent an additional probably $600,000 when the pipes froze, so they repaired the plumbing. So I'm not sure why they would make that investment and then abandon this vital center. So I'm the president of a nonprofit called Print Arts Northwest, and we are a nonprofit that's been around since 1980, so 45 years, and we do a lot of education around the art of printmaking through exhibitions. We do professional development for younger people. People have just graduated from college. They don't teach how to be an artist in college, so that's one of the things that we do. We have educational programs that promote the creation and appreciation of prints, and we also go into the schools with our presses. Wow. So occasionally we teach children, and we do free education and demonstrations of printmaking. So we've gone to the Portland Art Museum and done print demos there, and we just did a three-day printmaking demo at the that was free for the public at the Gathering of the Guilds.
Wow.
So we've moved seven times in the past 25 years because rents are so unaffordable for arts organizations in this city. And here we are looking at moving again.
Oh, so you are at the MAC. That's an office that you have
we
there.
We are.
Wow.
Yeah, we are at Multnomah Arts Center. We rent one of the cottages along with the Oregon Children's Theater.
Mm-hmm. This just makes no sense. I mean, doesn't the facility make more money than what Novak believes would be saved on an annual basis?
I believe that MAC probably loses money. The city has been trying to get Multnomah Arts Center to pull its own weight, quote unquote, for years. But when you are trying to allow organizations like mine to have a space that doesn't cost $2,000 a month, you're renting at, you know, market levels, but they're not making a huge amount of money off of us. Right. They're also having affordable art classes for children. So that's where they're losing money, is probably by employing art teachers to teach children and also retired people, and any number of the general public about courses like printmaking, basket weaving, music and dance, and other forms of art. They also have a little sculpture studio, and they have a ceramic studio, and they host incredible events, community events, like the sale that they do four times a year, so that their students who are making art can actually sell their pieces.
So how can MAC fight this?
Well, I'm sure that they've been doing their best to get the word out to the community. There's a nonprofit organization that exists at the Multnomah Arts Center called MACA, which is Multnomah Arts Center Association, and they get a lot of support from the community, and they're a nonprofit, so you can give a tax deductible contribution to them, but. They help with the gallery there, and they have programs in music, movement, dance, theater, literary arts, metal arts, mixed media. They're the ones that that help promote these programs year-round, and they provide scholarships for people who can't afford the expensive art classes that might take place out in the private sector.
Right.
Wow.
This is some fabulous information. Thank you so much. I hope the city, because isn't the motto of Portland is to keep Portland weird, right? And the whole thing was a local arts community that made it a unique place. I mean, we have murals on buildings all over.
Yeah, absolutely. And here is a physical arts hub. And they want to kill it. It's further going to undermine our vulnerable creative community.
Yes.
And our creative economy.
Take all the fun out of our life.
So artists really need support now more than ever.
Yes, it does. Jane, I really appreciate your time and your information. And I have to let you go because we have another caller. That's the last one, okay? Hi, Santiago.
Good morning, Sherry.
How are you?
You know, I'm doing okay. How about yourself?
I am fabulous, except I'm really mad right now.
No, I feel you. You know, the city of Portland is, the city of Portland, especially via Prosper Portland, you know, because right now Prosper Portland is trying to is trying to shove a music venue down the throats of the local music community.
Yes, I know.
You know, because they're trying to bring Live Nation to the trying to bring a Live Nation venue out here. And you know, it doesn't surprise me at all. You know, Steve Novak was the cat who did a closed door meeting that got that backdoored Uber and Lyft into Portland. So that's not surprising at all. But I mean, the fact of the matter is that like, where this is just the consequence of living in the neoliberal area we're currently in, where rather than the state working on behalf of the people mm-hmm. to protect us from the dynamics of the market, you know, it's we have states that now work towards protecting businesses from the outrage of the people due to the dynamics of the market. And I think there's a part of me that is like, it's surprised, but at the same time it's like they're doing the same thing to libraries. I mean, a lot of it is about like trying to reduce the amount of spaces that people can simply exist in without paying a fee, as we're moving towards what some people call, they like saying, oh, you know, we need to run government like a business, but you know, we're so thoroughly indoctrinated into the idea of running a business and how everything needs to make money. But the fact of the matter is that like things that are necessary for people to live are not good for business in the sense
government
that, like,
is not a business.
You can't. Yeah, it's not a business, but it's like people talk about, oh, it's not, you know, the art center is pulling its weight. It's like, no, the state should be pulling the weight. Because when you're providing services to a community, it comes not necessarily, I mean, it comes at a loss, but it's like,
it's not,
it's
not a loss, Santiago. I'm going to interrupt here. It is not a loss. And that is the point. The intrinsic value of intangible community connections, intangible. So a tangible item is like a chair or like revenue or something you can hold. Intangible are the things that you as a person on the outside cannot see. What people on the outside see is a building. What those of us who are involved in the community see is life. It's happiness, it's art, it's freedom. Those are intangible values that cannot be calculated on a spreadsheet.
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to get at, is they see it as it being run at a loss, but you're right. It's about the idea that the value that it provides to the community goes beyond whether it goes up or down in the quarterly stock earnings or whatever. And I mean, a lot of that just comes from the fact that so many of us have been indoctrinated into a system where we have to think not only about like community resources, but even ourselves. Do we think of ourselves as profitable? Do we think of ourselves as a benefit or a drain? And it's just, we have to get past like using ourselves as like, even using ourselves as a barometer for how the economy is doing. But I mean, point is that, you know, this is why it's so important to start. We need to advocate for, you know, the Medicare for All Oregon, because at the end of the day, there's businesses that are required to pay for medical insurance that can't afford it. And so they, you know, and it comes out of their paycheck where it comes out of, you know, they pass it on to the people who work there, where if the state was actually paying for it, it would, you know, theoretically free up more money for the people. But also it gives us the ability to move. If we're tired of a job, but the only thing tying us to the job is our healthcare benefits,
right?
You know, it's disgusting. But on a further note, it's about the fact that we need to take money away from, we need to take the money away from the people who have this ability to dictate how we can live in this world. Because as long as we have people who continue to have more money than God, you know, they ultimately in a capitalist society, they can dictate everything that we do. So, you know, we definitely need Medicare for All Oregon, but I think the further vision is taking away money from the people who have it so they can't continue to exploit us at our own detriment.
Hey, Santiago, thank you for your wise words. As always, I have to let you go because I have to do one real quick thing before we close. Thank you. Did he go?
Right, no.
Hi. I couldn't tell if he was still on or not because I have to let you guys know that we are in the middle of KBOO's summer camp fundraising drive. This is a fabulous opportunity for our supporters, who we completely adore, to help us continue our mission to inform you and entertain you with public affairs, news, music, special programming, all of it. And the best way that you can help us raise $50,000 between now and June 29th is by donating. You can go to kboo.fm/give. $5. That's a cup of coffee. I just spent $5.50 for a cup of coffee this morning. I could have given that to KBOO. Clicking go to the mobile app and click on the red box that says donate. You can text KBOO to 44321. Or for those who aren't into the tech, you can mail a check. We accept paper. KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, and that is in Portland, zip code 97214.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th. Thank you.
By the mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Up next, it's Outcasting. This edition was produced